Hey everyone, welcome to the Team Flower Podcast. My name is Kelly and we are going to dig right in today. If you're new here, I just want to let you know that we talk about flower discoveries. We have an interview with a special guest. A lot of times that is a floral designer, but we have all kinds of different people from the flower world here. So no matter what you do with flowers, whether you grow, design, create, sell, give flowers, if flowers are a part of your life and you resonate with the mission of loving the world through flowers, this is the right place for you. You have found a family to dream with. So let's dig in. Welcome to the Team Flower Podcast. My name is Kelly, and I'm here with the team. Hi, team.
Hi.
Hello.
Welcome to all of our listeners today. It is so great to be here with you. Thank you for coming to the podcast party this week. We have a fun interview, great article coming up, and we're going to do just a quick flower discovery today. Janine has been reading a book, and she's going to tell us about it.
Yeah, I have been reading a book called A Life in the Studio by Frances Palmer, and she is a potter and grower, and I would say she's a designer too. So we've actually had Frances on the podcast before, which was what got me interested in the book, and then Kelly and Jesse gave me the book for Christmas, which was so sweet. So I've started reading it, and it definitely is one of those books that's like, you would want to have on your coffee table because it's gorgeous. The pottery that she makes is incredible. And then the arrangements that she puts into her pottery are just breathtaking, really. She just writes about her life and how, just some lessons she's learned, how to make pottery. There's so much in there. But I recently read her short chapter on like practicing patience, and it really spoke to just the season of life that I'm living right now. In every facet, both from, or I guess, yeah, from family aspect to my current floral, what I'm doing kind of process. And she speaks specifically about how she has had to practice patience from the very beginning of learning how to make a pot, to learning how to market herself, to reaching out to people, to so on and so forth. And it's been so many years that she has been in this business, and yet she's still practicing patience. It's just something that is always a big part of who she is and what she needs to do. And it just really spoke to me because, like I said, that's something that I've realized recently that I am needing to practice even more right now. But it's also, I know we all have heard the saying, patience is a virtue. And it is. But it's something that I think I know I can grow in every day, all the time. And I just wanted to encourage anyone who's listening who feels like they're struggling with practicing patience that you're not alone. And I know that it's hard, and we can do it together. We're here to hold each other up and learn from one another. Like, I'm learning from Frances and what patience looks like for her, and reflecting on that for myself. We can all do that together.
Cool. I'm with you. I'm with you on that for sure. And she speaks so beautifully too. When I think about, you know, reading the book and what I took away from it, I keep going back to how she talked about how she worked through her business when she was a mom at different stages in life. And I just found that to be really comforting. Leanne, who grows the dahlias, she asked me if I had had my like big mom reconciliation, like that there would be maybe this period where I would like have this thing about that I would reconcile the ideas that I had about what I was going to do in the season of life versus what's actually able to be accomplished in the season of life. I'm just like, have you had that reconciliation yet? And I was like, I don't know. But this week I was like, I think it's happening. I think it's happening. It's been a big year of stretching for everyone, right? I mean, for so, in so many ways, it's like, it's one thing to have, you know, something personal that's going on. And then there's like just magnification in so many areas and in so many levels that just goes across all of the different facets of life and business. And we're doing our best. It would probably be good just to say good job to ourselves for a minute, right?
I could receive that.
Yeah. So good job for hanging in there. And just whatever it looks like, it's good to walk through without having to judge it. And I, goodness, I was somewhere, I saw this little tidbit about whenever you come up against a challenge and you think like, oh, I can't do that, or I'm, you know, this challenge is too hard, or, you know, something like that, about how rephrasing it to say something like, what is Kelly going to do about that? Instead of, I can't do anything about that right now. And I realized just like the way that I actually feel in my body whenever I pose it as like just this sort of like question out there, it feels better and a little bit more open about like, how could I handle this challenge? Because I don't know about all of you, but I feel like I've become pretty challenge averse in some ways, because things have just been so hard and so fast in such a short period of time. And so it's kind of this like wanting to pull back and, afraid to take on some big stuff. So, and I think that's okay from time to time, but, or, you know, it's okay all the time, whatever needs to happen. But, okay, cool. Well, we're going to move on to a very different topic, which is about having an amazing hotel flower business. but it was good to have a little heart to heart there. Just know that we're all doing the best, we're all doing our best and, making it work. So we'll head over there and talk to Francesca now. Today, our special guest is Francesca Mitko, and she is from The Hotel Florist, based in Houston, Texas, although she has a big desire to travel. And so she has been all over the place in this last year, and it's going to be fun to hear a little bit about her story and also the role that she plays in Flower World. She's an international floral designer providing turnkey floral solutions for luxury brands, including JW Marriott, Fairmont Hotels, Four Seasons, Hilton Hotels, and more. In 2020, she began freelancing internationally and launched the Hotel Florist Profit Method, which is an online course designed to educate wedding and event florists on how to create consistent $5,000 months by landing hotel floral contracts. And as the artistic director behind the Hotel Florist, she has combined her sense of wanderlust and her love of slinging stems, allowing her to live, work, and play in more than 47 countries and counting. Welcome, Francesca.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Okay, give us the rundown on what it's like to work with these hotels and what kind of products are you providing for them? What's it like to step inside that world? We haven't talked with anybody who works so closely with this hotel side of floral design. So I'm excited to get a little peek inside your world.
Absolutely. So let me take you back to 2014. I was in events. I was in the events world and based in the Middle East. That's where I was currently living at the time. And I remember being at the Four Seasons Istanbul and looking at the lobby flowers thinking, wow, that is a dream job. Like, I cannot believe that somebody actually gets paid to come in here and put flowers in this beautiful hotel lobby. Now, with a background in hotels, my degree's in hotel and restaurant management, I've worked in hotels, both on the property level and the corporate level. I had kind of fallen into the events world by, I don't want to say fault, or it was just more so of an opportunity, but knew that I was looking for a change. And so in 2015, I started my company, which was Francie's Flower Design, and we specialize in weddings because I thought that's what you did as a florist. I thought that's where you had the biggest budgets, and that was where all the business was. And as I continued building my business, I quickly realized that I just never felt aligned in that industry, not because I didn't appreciate it or love my clients, but there was a lot of things that I struggled with, especially when it came to creativity and always feeling restricted with some sort of ever-changing budget. And so in 2017, I decided that I really needed some secure income. I wanted to get an annual contract. And really, the only big clients that were offering that were hotels. And so I started using my previous knowledge and education in hotels and then my recently developed knowledge in floral design to go in and pitch to hotels to work specifically for them. And I landed my first contract in that year. And I realized that as I was working with these hotels, they didn't really know what they wanted or needed, but they knew they had a certain budget and I knew what I could offer for that. And so we have really niched down now to the hotel florist and we offer turnkey floral solutions for luxury hotels.
Very cool. Tell us a little bit about what business has looked like over, you know, the past year and where are things trending in that industry?
Oh, well, I think like everyone, and especially here in the floral world, nobody was untouched. I remember I had completely restructured. I took all of 2019 to restructure my business to not be dependent on one location. And I did that because I really wanted to travel more. And I thought if I could utilize my skill set, run my business back home, but remotely and travel, and that skill set could afford my travels, that could be a really cool challenge. And so 2020 started and I, you know, was in Kenya, I was in Africa and South Africa and the UAE, and then I was in Australia. And I remember COVID was starting to loom. And at one point I had finished all my freelancing opportunities and commitments and decided that it was probably time to go home just because there was so much unknown. And while I was, you know, freelancing, I was noticing that events were canceling or not even canceling at this point. They were just postponing. And then, you know, Chanel started pulling events and then, you know, other really big clients started pulling events. But I was like, well, you know what? The hotels are never going to pull any of their business. They're hotels. They're open 24/7, 365 days a year. And I remember flying home via Tokyo and being in the lounge waiting for my flight. And I got the email from the general managers that I was working with that all contracts were suspended. And obviously you could enforce your force majeure clause if you wanted to, but I also believe the hospitality business is a very much a people business. And, you know, we went with legal with, well, what should we do? Should we enforce the contracts? And they were like, they're literally telling you they cannot afford to pay you. So it's up to you if you want to burn that bridge or if you want to, you know, just say, please remember me, you know, when business comes back. And so 2020, of course, there was a few months where it was really quiet. It was unknown, you know, out of nowhere, revenues had stopped. That's obviously very scary for a business owner. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to take this time to dive into the online course world. It's something I'd always fascinated me. And I started initially with a course to help women go from corporate to self-employed, just as I had done, because I have really loved the life I've created for myself from my business. But quickly missed the floral community and went back and created a course called the Hotel Florist Profit Method, which teaches florists exactly what I'm doing. And I did not release that course until my hotel contract started to come back just because I didn't feel like it was ethical. And the contract started coming back on a monthly basis. But as of this year, they're starting to come back weekly in Q2. So it seems like a very long-winded explanation, but it looks like the hotel and the hospitality industry are getting back on their feet.
Cool. Tell us what it's like to go in there and to make some of those initial contacts and pitches with some of the hotels.
So I think it can be very intimidating. That's probably the number one thing I hear from either students or potential students or just, you know, the florists that I'm friends with, is it's very intimidating to go in. You don't really know who to talk to. It's kind of like a web of multiple people. And it's very hard sometimes to figure out the hierarchy or who's the actual decision maker. And for me, I always go into a property that I want to work with. And first and foremost, I'm their guest, whether that's I'm getting a glass of champagne at the bar or a cup of coffee in the lobby, or I'm, you know, splashing out and staying a night or having a meeting at that property. Because once you're on site, you are a guest. You're no longer a vendor. And there's so much more that you can learn. You can obviously see what's happening in the hotel. Do they have arrangements? You can pretty quickly figure out who's kind of in charge, or you can start chatting with someone and then ask them if you could speak to, you know, a manager. And just the conversation happens very fluid. I mean, again, this is a hospitality industry. It's a people industry. Their job is there to take care of people, and it's all about the guest experience. And so anyone listening who has thought about going into hotels and being a designer for a hotel, an in-house florist, I always say start with going in and being a guest and making sure that it's the right fit for you.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the types of flowers that you feel like are really cornerstones in hotel design work and how that's different than what you did whenever you were doing a lot of weddings.
Absolutely. So the flowers, I want to say, are completely different. I'm not going to say night and day, but definitely very, very different. Recently, actually, in the course, I have like over 50 types of flowers that are my go-tos. But they're flowers that you typically wouldn't necessarily use in wedding and event work or wouldn't use in this way. So like some of my staples for right now, for example, are dried flowers, just because now we're having to do monthly installs. And so, you know, it's a lot of like pampas and mass, or it's a lot of different branches, or it could be like a whole install of different types of orchids. Limonium is one of my favorite. So it's just getting creative with what dries easily and what looks good in mass. Whereas, you know, with your wedding and event work, it's really, can this flower last 24 to 72 hours? Whereas in hotel work, it's like, can this flower last more than 7 days? Because on day seven, it has to look just as good as it did on day one.
Mm, yes, very good. I love the idea of, you'd mentioned the orchids and like even incorporating maybe some, you know, some things that are blooming plants and things like that into the arrangements as well. And you also made a big point about the how things look in mass and on a different scale, because it really is, I mean, there are some things in weddings that are, you know, grand scale pieces, but we also do a lot of things that are really small. How do you feel like designing for a hotel space and the scale of it? How do you calculate, you know, when you walk into a place, like how big does this need to be? Do you kind of have some standard size product offerings that you go back to, or what's that recommendation process look like whenever you go in there and you're designing for the space?
For me, it's all about balance, and also when it comes to height, width, shape, color, scent, a lot of that is also determined by ownership. So some of it's brand standards and some of it's ownership. For example, when I first started with a property, they gave me a list of their brand standards and we were executing them. But week after week for maybe like 2 months, and this is right when I had first started, so I would handle it completely different now, but it just was never tall enough. And I didn't understand what they meant when they said, we need it bigger, or we need, can we go larger? You know, because those are the kind of words that they would use. And it took me a while. And then finally I was like, how high do you actually want it? Like, do you want it touching the ceiling? Do you want it 2 inches below the ceiling? Whereas that had nothing to do with their brand standards. And so I first would start with understanding what's required, understanding what ownership actually wants to see. And then if both of those are clear, or both of those are kind of flexible, then for me, it's all about balance and symmetry. So when I'm training new team members, or whenever we're stepping back from a design, trying to figure out how we can tweak it, I always say, imagine if we could fold this in half as if it was a piece of paper, and both sides need to reflect the other side, because the last thing you want a guest to do when they arrive is look at it and they have no focal point for their eye. They're not really sure what they're looking at. They're kind of all over the place, which causes subconscious stress. And this is part of their arrival experience versus coming in and it's naturally pleasing. It's relaxing to the eye. It's balanced. And then they remember such a better arrival experience by just the floral arrangement behind the front desk.
Very cool. Can you elaborate a little bit on what brand standards, some examples of what those would be for somebody who's maybe not familiar with that industry? Is it a booklet that you receive? How do you think through and interpret those from, you know, into floral language?
Absolutely. So some properties are more specific on their brand standards than others. Like, for example, all Marriott properties typically have brand standards. So JW has their own versus a Marriott, et cetera. Someone like Four Seasons, they don't really have brand standards, which is really bizarre to me because a Four Seasons guest is probably a lot more discerning and needs more high touch experiences than even a guest of a JW. But just as an example, if you go to the Georges Sank in Paris, where Jeff Latham is their in-house florist, he takes care of four properties now in the Four Seasons portfolio. It is, I think they have something, they have some ridiculous annual floral budget, hundreds and thousands of dollars. Whereas if you go to a Four Seasons in Houston, their whole theme is coffee table books. So there is, I feel like within the Four Seasons brand, it's not as cohesive as in, say, Westin. Westin is very specific with their brand standards. It's all about holistic, botanical. They love things, they being the brand, of succulents and white orchids and anything that's going to feel really relaxing and pleasing to the eye. Their colors are mostly green and white. Whereas with some other properties, it might be more vibrant, or some properties might not want to have any sort of scent. So it really depends on the brand of the hotel, what the property is looking for.
So a brand standard would be something like, our colors are green and white, our feeling is, you know, spa, relaxation.
Correct.
Like, is that, that's kind of like, there's a list.
Exactly.
Like, this is who we are. This is what we're doing and going for. And then you were mentioning the owner, that would be the actual person who's owning that specific hotel and how they're interpreting those brand standards through their lens and their unique property layout and all of those kinds of pieces. Do I have that right?
Yes, absolutely. And the thing with ownership that can be a bit tricky is not all hotels are owned by that brand. Most of them they're actually franchised. So let's say, Kelly, that you have a building and you want to make it the Kelly Hotel by Westin. And so Westin doesn't own your hotel, you do. But you hire Westin, you pay them a management fee every year to manage your hotel, so you get the best profit margin at the end of the day. And so a Westin I recently worked with, I was following their brand standards, but actually ownership decided to make a plant wall against the brand standards. And so it was like a whole issue internally, had nothing to do with me, but ownership often does what they want to do. They kind of like do it and then they ask for forgiveness later versus asking for permission in the beginning. So that's why it's so important as a florist to understand ultimately, initially, what the brand standards are, but ultimately the decision maker, like what it is that they actually want to see in the property.
This has been so helpful to understand who the different players are in that world and who is working towards what kind of goal and how you can come in and, you know, support and deliver something that helps everybody move forward and reach their goals, including, and most importantly, the guests. I love how you talked about that subconscious stress that we can experience when we walk into a space and how part of our job is to alleviate that and to give people something really beautiful to focus on. So that's a really beautiful way to think about kind of how we function and what our role is in that space. And I'm so thankful for the work that you're doing in Texas and the work that you're doing all over the world to greet people and to bring ease and relaxation. It's really, really cool. Francesca,
thanks.
Thank you. Okay. I have two more quick questions. The first one is, how do you think we can cut down on waste? I imagine that that's an important piece of profitability in this puzzle. And, also my other question is just, what do you take whenever you're doing an install, whenever you go on event day? So those are my last two questions, whichever one you want to run with.
Okay. So how do we reduce waste? Sustainability is very important to me. It's actually one of the issues I have with the floral world is all the single-use plastic. I just feel like there's so many other alternatives that are plant-based. So I try to do my part. It's difficult for me to buy local. If I could, I totally would. But the types of flowers and the lifespan I need of them, we just don't have that anywhere around the hotels that I'm currently servicing. So what I do try to do is order flowers that I know can be used twice. So 2 weeks in a row, if I were to switch out some, you know, other flowers and rearrange the vases, so it would be a new install, but I could maximize the longevity of the florals. It is also great for your profit margins as well. And also being able to dry flowers and reuse them later on, whether that's in the holidays or especially right now, when they're only doing monthly installs. So I try to really maximize whatever I'm buying. And then when it comes to installing and what I'm bringing with me, that's definitely some trail mix and some water and probably my tripod, because I'm always trying to grab either time lapses or pictures. It's so easy to get caught up in our craft because it's just so natural to us and we're there, quote unquote, on a job. But it's been fascinating to watch just the evolution and then also share that with other people and see how much your flowers bring them joy. So I'm always trying to grab content and then share that as and when I can.
Really insightful. Great ideas. I love trail mix, water, and tripods. Those are great.
Yeah.
Those are all things that we forget sometimes. So yeah. I'm glad that you highlighted those as being very important. Anything that you might like to say or share with people who love flowers just like you do that are listening in today, a word of encouragement, a quote, what's on your heart? What's in your heart for the community today?
When I first started my floral journey, I really thought I had to fit in a box. When I started, I was in the Middle East. I was outside of Dubai. Like I said, I got started with weddings. And then I quickly, a year later, moved to Houston. And then a year later, moved to Dallas. And I was always very reactive. And it took me several years to realize that I didn't have to just do what everyone else was doing or feel bad that I didn't want to do those things, or maybe I wasn't even as good at those things as somebody else, no matter how hard I tried. And so whatever it is that you're feeling called to do, even now, if I tell someone I specialize in hospitality floral design, nobody really knows what that is. So I've just called it the hotel florist, but that's still such a unique concept. But what we're actually doing isn't that unique, but it is a very niche down area of the floral industry. And so if there's something that really sparks you or you're very curious on how it works, I would just say focus on that and build your business around what brings you joy versus what you feel like you should be doing in order to be successful.
Really good. Thank you for sharing, everybody. Francesca is on Instagram. I'll spell it out just to make sure that we've got all the spelling right. It's Francesca dot MCCAUGHAN. And then at the Hotel Florist is her other Instagram account. And again, you can find her at the Hotel Florist. Anything else that we need to know in order to get in touch with you, Francesca?
No, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay, let's head over and chime in with one of our members next.
Hello, I'm Presley Williams, and I operate a small flower and vegetable farm in Matthews, North Carolina, right outside of Charlotte, called Renfro Farms. And my family also operates a small hardware store and garden center called Renfro Hardware. I work at both places. Today, I want to talk about how to grow anemone flowers. I have a quick and yet comprehensive guide in which I want to share that information with you. Anemone flowers are one of the toughest, most productive, earliest blooming, and longest lasting flowers that you can grow. We love to grow them on our farm in the Charlotte, North Carolina area. This crop is a fantastic addition to even the smallest of cutting gardens. These beautiful blooms require a bit of knowledge and work to grow effectively, but the rewards are more than worth the effort. Sourcing anemones. If you are looking for anemone bulbs, one of the first things you might discover is that anemones actually grow from corms, which are little things that look like acorns that are a solid stem base of the plant. However, many refer to them as anemone bulbs, and if you're searching the internet for supplies, that phrase might yield better search results. Large wholesale suppliers for anemone corms for flower farms. If you're a flower farmer looking for wholesale suppliers, I recommend suppliers such as Glockner, who's actually just bought out by Ball. So check with Ball or Awnings. There are others out there as well. Typical minimum orders are 150 to 250 or 500 anemone corms per color or type. Smaller suppliers of anemone bulbs for cutting gardens and micro farms. If you're looking to order on a smaller scale, perhaps for your small cutting garden, micro farm, or home flower bed, I suggest Florette Flowers or our farm, Renfro Farms, if you are local to the Charlotte area. You'll typically receive 10 to 20 corms per package. Since writing this article, many other flower farms have also added selling anemone corms online to their customers, and I think you could find many different choices through an Instagram or Facebook search. You can occasionally find anemone flowers at big box stores, garden centers, or other online retailers, but these are often not the varieties best suited for cut flowers, in my opinion and experience. The stems are shorter, and they are usually available only in a mix of colors. If you are planning to grow blooms to sell, do check out wholesale suppliers. When you place your anemone corm orders, wholesale orders should be placed in the spring and summer for delivery in the fall and winter. Shipping typically begins in September, so there is ample time to pre-sprout your crop. Anemone flower colors and varieties. There are many anemone flower varieties to choose from. They also come in a wide range of vibrant colors listed below. Purple, blue, pink, red, burgundy, white with green centers, white with dark centers, which is the popular panda anemone type. There are a few different bicolors. There's pastel pinks and several different purplish shades. I recommend the following varieties when growing for cut flower work. Jerusalem, Galilee, Maroon, Carmel, Marianne. There are some others as well, and check with your growing climate recommendations before making your purchases. How to pre-sprout anemone flowers. Remember, anemones grow from those little corms. Soak your corms for several hours in a full bucket of cool water to hydrate and plump them up, keeping water dripping and water overflowing the bucket so that oxygen is continuously added to the water. That's a very important step. For optimal results, pack the corms in damp vermiculite and store at around 35 degrees Fahrenheit for several weeks or up to a month, checking periodically. When roots are at least a quarter inch long, emerge like in the photo provided on the website version of this podcast, they are ready to be planted. You can also keep the temperature up a little bit higher than 35. I've done it up to 50 degrees, and they actually sprout a little bit quicker in that temperature. Toss any diseased or moldy corms. Alternatively, try potting your anemones into small pots or cell packs, and after cooling, pull them out and let them sprout in the sunlight before transplanting, keeping them well watered. Keep in mind that dry weather is not optimal for setting out pre-sprouted anemone flowers and ranunculuses. They could dry out before sprouting above ground and result in crop losses. A note for hobby gardeners and micro farmers. If you're a hobby gardener without a flower cooler, try planting your anemones in smaller pots or cell packs after soaking, keeping them moist and storing them in a shady and cool spot until you see them sprout. Once sprouted, plant them in the garden. Planting and growing anemone flowers. In warmer climates, you plant them out, the sprouted bulb corms out in the fall, usually October and November. I also put out another batch in December and or early January in my in my growing region. In colder northern climates, these plants won't survive the winter, so you will need to wait and plant them out in mid to late winter, January, February, maybe even later than that, depending on where you're located. Water them very heavily when first planted, or plan on planting them out before a very heavy rain. Anemone watering tips. While anemones depend on a consistent water supply to grow well, they also do not like overwatering or wet feet. So do not plant them in a low-lying spot with poor drainage. Side note, I have done that myself and lost quite a large crop of them before when we've had some extremely wet winters. So they really do need to not be in a potential floodplain. Fertilizing anemone flowers. As for fertilization, backyard gardeners can use the same organic gardening fertilizer that they use on other flowers and vegetables at planting. For instance, Espoma Organics Plant Tone or Garden Tone. Fertilize again once or twice during the growing season. For farmers, your corm supplier should provide you with detailed fertilizer recommendations. Setup and weed control notes for growing anemones. Anemones can successfully be grown in pots or raised beds. Regardless of where you plant them, space each corm approximately 9 inches apart. I space mine about 12 inches apart between the rows and 9 inches apart within the row, four rows wide, with 4 rows per 4 foot wide bed. Occasionally I will cram them a little bit closer than that, but that is a pretty safe spacing. Anemones can handle a variety of weeding methods, from landscape fabric or plastic to leaf mulch or hand weeding. Wintertime protection for anemones grown in the South. Recently on my farm in North Carolina, we had a very cold winter, and I covered my plants with a heavy row cover for the coldest week or two, but otherwise I left them uncovered and they still produced abundant tall stems in the spring. Protection through cold spells will enhance stem length, plant quality, and bloom quality, but I found that anemones are remarkably resilient, and small-scale growers in my climate can be successful without the additional infrastructure of a tunnel with plastic, though that will increase your quality, and especially if you are in a rainy area and really want to have a lot of high-quality white blooms, having a low tunnel of plastic or growing them in your high tunnel or greenhouse will prevent some loss due to rain spots on the blooms. Harvesting anemone flowers for cut flower work. To harvest them for the most extended vase life, collect flowers when the bloom has grown to be about a quarter inch above the little collar leaf on the stem beneath it. They'll still be a little bit closed up at that point. If you harvest blooms earlier, the blooms will be a smaller size, but they last longer. When you harvest later, blooms will not last as long in the vase, but they will be larger and still potentially able to be used in short-term designs for weddings and other events. The stem lengths will be very short at the beginning of the season, but then will stretch to 12 to 18 inches if you keep harvesting them. Harvesting tool sanitation. Always practice good sanitation for extended vase life. Sanitize your clippers or shears. Use clean water. Change the water of blooms you're holding in the cooler every other day and give the held stems a fresh cut. These conditions will typically provide at least a week of vase life. Weather and harvesting plans. Rainy and or cold weather will cause splotches and browning on the petals, especially on the white and pastel varieties like I mentioned a moment ago. So prioritize harvesting anemones before a storm or a very cold night if either are in the forecast and you need them. Cut flower storage for anemone blooms. Store upright to keep stems from bending. Blooms can be stored in a cold floral cooler for several days without impact on vase life. If you have holding solutions, you can use them. I typically just use clean water. It is very important to store them upright to keep the stems from being bent. Harvest season for anemone flowers. Anemones are ready for harvest in winter and early spring in the southern U.S. and as and in the spring in the northern U.S. climates. My plants start blooming by late February, sometimes earlier, in North Carolina zone 7BE/8A. They can begin blooming even earlier than that in unheated high tunnels or low tunnels or in a heated greenhouse space. Regarding field-grown, minimally protected anemones in zone 7B and 8A, the season can often run from mid to late February through late April, with a bit of leeway on either side of the season depending on how warm or cold our winter and spring temperatures are each year. A note on low-growing tunnels. I focus almost exclusively on field-growing crops and have only dabbled in experimentation with low tunnels, which is a short, unheated, greenhouse-type structure over one row of plants in the field that provides a few degrees of protection in the coldest temperatures. My family also owns and operates a 120-year-old mom-and-pop-style hardware store in historic downtown Matthews, North Carolina, and the biggest part of our business is gardening, which makes me prioritize being at our store most days in the late winter and spring. And because I'm not at the farm full time, I personally tend to not utilize tunnels with plastic because I'm unable to continuously vent them and check on them on days when they heat up in the sunshine. Anemones do not like temperatures that climb above the mid-60s, and temperatures in a closed plastic covering structure can quickly surpass that on a cold but sunny day without proper ventilation. So if you're a casual backyard gardener or a very new grower in a warm climate like mine, I recommend growing them for the first time with no more protection than an occasional row cover blanket during cold snaps below around 28 degrees. Anemones are low maintenance and more forgiving of occasional neglect than many other flowers, which is another reason that I love them so much. Saving anemone corms. At the end of the season, when the corms are about to go dormant, which is triggered by temperatures climbing in the 70s and above, I let my flowers fully bloom open for a few days without harvesting. I do this so that as I dig up the corms, I can be 100% certain about what color each corm is and sort any that got mixed up in planting or arrived mislabeled. I let the anemone corms dry out for a few days in the heat before cutting off all the foliage, bagging them up in mesh bags by color and variety, and storing them in a well-ventilated corner of our air-conditioned design studio workshop. Check the corms periodically so that if you notice any mold or disease, you can toss infected ones before they affect others. Then you can start the growing season all over again with pre-sprouting those saved corms in September or October. Anemones may also be perennialized in the field if you have space to leave them. Just don't forget where they are and don't let the weeds completely take over. Oversummered, dormant anemones will begin to pop up in the fall. The foliage looks a bit like curly parsley. I have had experience with losing some that way because I believe squirrels find the corms and think that they're acorns and then dig them up. So I don't expect a full perennialization percentage from season to season if I leave them in the field. I hope that this information gives you the confidence to add this gorgeous flower to your garden next season.
Thanks for listening. You can find us over at teamflower.org for more resources like this one. And while you're there, check out the Team Flower Conference. That's where we all gather to learn and grow together. It is magic. You are magic. The work that you do with flowers matters. And we are so grateful for you. Keep going. You're doing a good job.